From high atop Bronson Towers in Studio 1B in the heart of the high desert of Placitas, New Mexico, this is The Matthew Bronson Show. Welcome, this is The Matthew Bronson Show on KUPR 99.9 in the high desert of Placitas, New Mexico. And today, returning for a second time, but on a different subject, is Joseph Sorrentino. You may recall he was here a year or so ago talking about a comedic opera, I guess the genre is referred to as gonzo opera, that was performed locally.
Right.
But you are a photographer, playwright, author, and photography has been pretty much in south of the border for us.
Yeah, I've done a number of projects here in New Mexico also, but now I'm currently situated in just outside of Mexico City.
And you have a couple of publications out, one, you know, a book and one collection of photography and a combination. You want to just kind of give us an overview of what that is?
Sure.
Or those are?
Sure. My just to give a little background, I lived in Albuquerque for 6 years, I suppose, and I was still doing projects in Mexico, usually every other year, go down for a month. I do all my own photography for the articles that I write and the projects that I do. And I got interested in spending more time, and I read an article in an online publication called La Jornada del Campo about indigenous and they call them originarios, original pueblos. And I was fascinated that these pueblos exist in Mexico City, because Mexico City is such a huge city, modern. And I decided I wanted to go down to investigate a bit. I went down for Holy Week in 2018 to photograph. And I thought the week-long processions every day, really interesting fiestas. Decided to go down, return in August of 2018 for 3 weeks to see if it would be a place to live. Thought it would be my home base where I would do a lot of traveling around Mexico and Central America. And then I got interested in doing a year-long project. It's almost a fiesta, 3 or 4 days a week.
My kind of place. Yeah, all I recall about Mexico City, I was there in 1982, and even then, the, I guess, what would be called Indians, were still sitting on the streets, on the serapes, selling chiclets or whatever. And so here it is, like 30, 40 years later, and I'm sure it hasn't gotten any better. Back at that time, I was told there were more fountains in Mexico City than any other major city. And now pollution is supposed to be pretty bad.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no doubt the pollution that Mexico City is bereft with so many issues. The pollution is horrible, especially in the summer where the heat just traps this gray mass, this brownish gray mass. They're pumping out so much water. A lot of the water comes from the pueblo that I live in and the surrounding pueblos. There's so much water being pumped out. And Mexico City itself is built on a lake. The Aztecs designed this city, Tenochtitlan, with these canals. The Spaniards decided once they conquered the Aztecs that they knew more about the situation the Aztecs did. Started pumping out water, building roads over the canals. And now if you stand on streets in Mexico City, it looks like you're looking at a wave. The buildings are
right,
undulating. And there's a tremendous problems with water and pollution, but it's still, for me, a really interesting area.
Do you happen to recall how many people live in Mexico City?
The best estimate is about 25 million.
That's quite a bit.
Yeah, but I think, and my estimate is 50 million cars.
So somebody can afford a car, even if it pollutes.
So yeah, to drive in Mexico City, you need nerves of steel and a tremendous amount of patience.
Like New York City, without the bagels.
Worse.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about a couple of your publications. The first one is, I'm going to let you pronounce it.
San Gregorio Atlapulco, Cosmovisiones, Cosmovisions. So that was a year-long project. I got the idea to spend a year documenting the fiestas. Every neighborhood has a patron saint, and so every patron saint has...
Every neighborhood?
Every neighborhood.
And how many blocks is a neighborhood?
Depends. There are these lay religious leaders called mayordomos, and mayordomos are in charge of various fiestas, various holidays. And I asked a friend of mine, how many mayordomos are there? And his best guess was 300. And okay. So each one has a patron saint. Each one is in charge of a fiesta and other and doing certain events at the church, cleaning the church, cleaning the altars. And
they're three or four a week.
At least, I would guess. And that's not including the quinceañeras, the weddings, the funerals, and things like that.
No wonder they don't have time to make a living. They're partying.
I said to a friend of mine down there one time when I first moved there, I'm like, well, when do people work? And she just said, well, there are more important things in life than work. These mayordomos, depending on, they serve usually for a year in that position.
It's elected or appointed by the church?
The church is involved. They're not appointed by the church. And I'm not clear. I've asked my friend Javier a dozen times to explain some of these things to me, and it's not the language. It's just really, for me, very complicated. But they'll wait. They'll get on a list and wait for 10 years to be a mayordomo. And they save up all their money, and because they, during the fiesta, they're responsible for everything, to pay for the meals, to pay for the bottle rockets. And when I talk about bottle rockets to my friends here in the United States, they think, oh, you know, we have bottle rockets. We have, and no, you don't have bottle rockets. You have these little
like
things.
Air missiles.
You have these little things that go, you know, pop, and these are explosions, and they'll set off there during the fiesta for San Gregorio, the patron saint of San Gregorio. It was in September, is the major feast day for him. 90 minutes of bottle rockets, continual, in the churchyard. It was like a war, and I went down there, and it was just completely covered with smoke.
Yeah, and the smell of gunpowder. And are you familiar with the matachinas in Bernalillo?
Yeah.
So, as I understand it, if you get the privilege of hosting the Matachina statue or whatever, you keep it in your home for a year.
Right.
And then you're very active in the festival. That waiting list is well over 10 years also to have the honor of doing that. So it's not that dissimilar.
No, it's a lot of these things. I mean, there's so much more interchange and exchange commerce back hundreds and or even more, 1,000 years ago, than we imagine. So there's all these connections between the indigenous groups.
So how are you accepted? I would think, you know, American, Caucasian, even though you have a pretty good tan going, are people cautious of you? Why are you here? What do you want?
I've been really fortunate. San Gregorio is known as a closed community, a closed pueblo. Going back to the colonial era, what had happened was the Spaniards designated it a republic of Indians, or an Indian republic, because there was so much dengue fever and malaria in the early mid-1500s that Spaniards didn't want to enter there. So they developed this identity. San Gregorio developed this identity and is known as being closed. My first trip down there, I met Javier Marquez Guarez, who's one of the co-authors on the book. And Javier just knows everything about the pueblo.
You just kind of ran into him at the...
Well, it was a friend of a friend introduced me, and we got to talking during Holy Week, and he gave me some information. When I returned in August, we made our first trip. The thing that's fascinating down in San Gregorio is in the hills are ruins that are at least 1,000 years old, Mexica, Aztec ruins that we've been exploring for a year. And we finally got some archaeologists interested. So I think because I developed a close friendship with Javier and was seen with him a lot, it was okay, maybe this guy's all right. San Gregorio is definitely not a club med destination. There are no hotels. There's really two restaurants, one that's only open on the weekends. It's not picturesque. And the people who live in San Gregorio call themselves chicuarotes. And chicuarote is a small chile that's grown in only in San Gregorio. And it's known to be resistant and tough and spicy. So people call themselves chicuarote. And I was coming back from photographing a pilgrimage, and we're sitting in the back of a truck, six or eight of us. And people are curious, you know, a lot of people ask me, what are you doing here? Why are you in San Gregorio?
And from a curious point of view or from an aggressive point of view?
No, curious, because I've been there so long. You know, like, you know, most people come and go. What do you like about San Gregorio? And I explain the fiestas, the indigenous rituals, the ceremonies. And Aurelio, a friend of mine who's become a friend, said, oh, you're a gringo chicuarote.
Okay.
And that was a one step of acceptance. And then once we did the book, Javier and I worked really closely together, and we still do, to put the book together. And in when he signed my book, I asked him to sign my book, he said that I'm now fully a chicuarote, which was, to me, a huge compliment.
Sure. Do you get to learn the secret handshake, or...?
No, not yet. But
living accommodations, Joseph, when you can't pull out the Mexico City Daily Gazette or whatever and look for real estate listings, how did you find a place to live?
When I went down for Holy Week, I rented an Airbnb in Mexico City in an area that I really like, and I figured, well, I'll just go into San Gregorio, I'll take a cab or something and come back. And a cab ride is about 45 minutes from where I was staying into the Pueblo. And some of these events, all the events during Holy Week, they'll start at 7, 8 o'clock in the morning. They'll go to 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And I realized there's no way for me to go back and forth.
Right.
So we were having lunch, and I asked my contact there, is there any apartment that I could stay in? And she said, let me ask Carla. And... if there's an apartment that she knows. And Carla went to say, let me talk to my parents. And she came back. She said, yeah, my parents, the apartment that they have is empty. You can stay there. And I said, well, how much is it? She said, nothing.
Okay.
So I stayed there for 4 days, and that's the apartment that I now rent
in
San Gregorio.
But, you have all the normal conveniences.
Depends.
Well, a shower, a bathroom, and something to cook on.
Depends. When I first moved there, San Gregorio was hit pretty hard by an earthquake in September of 2017. A lot of damage. And when I went down in 2018, they had pretty much torn out the main water mains had been destroyed.
Right.
So my water was coming out of a well in the place that I lived, my apartment. And I'd have to heat the water up on a stove to take a shower. There was no running water for a couple of weeks.
Okay.
Now, we usually have running water. Almost always have running water and hot water, which is really nice.
Sure.
Yeah.
But you've spent a lot of time in different refugee camps.
Yeah.
So you're used to camping, as it were.
Used to roughing it, yeah.
But living under those conditions, not yourself, but the people who live like that year after year, decade after decade, does that alter their day-to-day life? I mean, do they just have a different perception of things? Like, they don't take a lot of long baths with Calgon or something.
No, everything is it's definitely limited. It's really a poor pueblo. People certainly work, but they're not earning a lot of money.
As far as village life, do... everything is local produce and fish, or?
Yeah, the San Gregorio has this area, agriculture area called Chinamparilla or Chinampa. It's actually that there is archaeological evidence that in certain areas the Chinampas go back as much as 5,000 or 6,000 years. And the ones in San Gregorio are probably somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 years old. And people still grow crops there. You may have seen, they have these in the tourist areas in Xochimilco, these beautiful boats
right. That
go along the canals. So that's more the touristy area. In San Gregorio, it's actually a very prolific agricultural area. And literally less than a 5-minute walk from my apartment, I'm in the Chinampas. And it's really pretty amazing because there's a main street in San Gregorio that is, my fear is I'm going to get plastered by a car crossing the street. That's one of my biggest fears in Mexico. It's just crossing the street is very challenging at times. But across that street, and I don't know, 100 yards, I'm in this huge area of Chinampas with canals and water, the waterways, and friends of mine, the Chinamperos, they're called, who grow crops there. Man, I mean, you go to the market and you're buying produce that was picked that morning.
No issue with your delicate American digestive system eating the food?
Everything has to be disinfected. The food has to be soaked in an iodine-based solution.
Even the locals?
Yep.
Where do they get iodine?
Well, they sell these little bottles. Mm-hmm. Microdine, it's called. You put 8 drops per liter, and you soak the vegetables for 10 minutes. When I first moved here, I asked a friend of mine, you know, I don't want to sound like a gringo, but I was in Oaxaca a few years ago, and a friend down there said, you know, you really got to disinfect your food. You have to soak it in this iodine. I said, is that true? And she looked at me. She's like, oh, my God, have you seen what they grow this stuff in? Of course you do that. And she was Mexican. It's because the water in the Chinampas is terribly polluted. People are dumping raw sewage into the canals.
Yeah. So back to the book, at least the first one, the... I'll let you say it again. Cosmos Venus?
Cosmovisiones.
Yeah. A vision of the universe? Is that kind of what it is?
Yeah.
Why did you pick that title?
Well, Javier did. I'm the photographer on the project. And he wrote...
No editorial input?
Very little. I wrote an introduction. And we talked about the text a little bit, but Javier is the expert in that situation.
So he had the concept for the book.
Well, it's interesting. It evolved. It started out as a year of fiestas. And then Javier Gisela, the other co-author, and I, as I started photographing, Javier and I were still going to the ruins in the hills, and we decided, well, we should expand it. I mean, I wrote about the Chinampas for some articles in the United States. We've been photographing in the ruins, and the ruins and the Chinampas are very important along with the fiestas. Why don't we expand the concept of the book? And it was a great idea. And it was I'm definitely glad we did it, but it was exhausting. I mean, I went on week-long pilgrimages. Chalma is a very important pilgrimage site in Mexico, and that was like 2.5 days. And I took some horse riding lessons because I knew I'd be riding a horse.
Right.
And Chalma wasn't too bad. I spent about 3 hours on the horse and about 10 hours walking. But then we did another pilgrimage to a village called Amatlan, and that was 12 hours on the horse.
That's a long time.
That was about 11 hours more than, and we got lost 4 times in the mountains, and I was the only one who seemed to be worried.
What's the big deal, Joseph?
And Javier kept saying, we're very close. And finally,
for 4 days.
Finally, we left San Gregorio at 8 o'clock in the morning, and finally at about 1 o'clock in the morning, we pulled into this village. We're all on horseback, we're exhausted. Somehow, 1 o'clock in the morning, a little tienda was still open. So we got some food and water, and Javier said, this is it. They're sending cars for us. We're done.
And I'm like, do they have telephones? How did they communicate?
Yeah, everyone's got cell phones down there. And
isn't that amazing? The most third world country has better cell connectivity than we do in many places.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, except in really remote areas, you're pretty well assured that you're gonna be able to connect with somebody. So they didn't exactly send cars. They sent a truck, and we finally just collapsed in the back. Actually, we slept on the sidewalk in this village. Everyone just laid down on the sidewalk waiting for transportation to take us to Amatlan. And we finally got there at 7 o'clock in the morning. So it was 24 hours that we were en route.
And what was your goal for going to this place?
My goal was staying alive.
Okay. You could have avoided that by just not going.
Yeah. Well, it's part of the book, you know. Yeah. So, it's another important religious site. And what's fascinating to me is even places like the Basilica for the Virgin of Guadalupe in Mexico City, all right. of these sites were originally indigenous, important indigenous religious sites. The Virgin of Guadalupe site in Mexico City, Chalma was originally a very important indigenous site. And then when the Spaniards came in, they made them Christian or Catholic sites. And some churches, in an area called Xochimilco, I've seen these, there'll be a colonial era church, and what the priests did to attract indigenous people and convert them was they took carved stones or statues of indigenous gods and put them in the exterior walls, and you can still see them.
Okay.
So the indigenous people felt a little more comfortable, and then the priests did their work to convert people. But every fiesta that I've been part of in San Gregorio, even if it's a Catholic, like during Holy Week,
right.
underlying it, there are indigenous ceremonies and rituals.
So are there a lot of, I guess what you'd call crypto-Catholics amongst the local people?
It's more of a melding. They're not hiding. There is some friction between the church in San Gregorio and the indigenous ceremonies. It depends. But the Aztec dancers will hold their dances in the churchyard.
Okay.
One time there was a ceremony where a young woman was being inducted into the organization, into the dancers. And I was photographing, and they had her walk on her knees into the church where a mass was going on. And I followed them, and I was photographing, and the priest was talking, and they were doing their ceremony. And I'm thinking, well, the priest is going to acknowledge their presence sooner or later. There must be some... Never. Never. They walked into the church. They did their ceremony. He kept giving his sermon. They walked out of the church, and that was it.
That must have been very mind-blowing.
It was definitely a little strange for me.
So once the young woman hobbles in on her knees and then leaves, is there a follow-up ceremony? She's now whatever it is she was supposed to be?
Yeah, there was this, and again, it's probably been explained to me, but there are so many rituals and ceremonies, I'm easily confused. It was obviously very important because the people who inducted her, then once she came out, they just gave her this huge hug and congratulated her. It was a really beautiful ceremony.
And then they had a fiesta.
Of course. Yeah, yeah. There's music.
Is this food and drink and alcohol or just
yes.
food? Oh, yeah. A lot of alcohol.
Not food. It's Mexico, man. You know, yeah. Tequila, tons of food. What's challenging for me is I'm a vegetarian, and it's very difficult.
Tequila's made from vegetables, so.
What's that?
Tequila's made from vegetables.
Yeah, it is. And is there something about drinking tequila at 10 o'clock in the morning that I'm still not accustomed to?
It's an acquired taste, I guess.
Break it out, man, you know? and it's fine. I mean, I'm okay with it. It's just I've got a photograph, and, you know, part of photographing is staying
being able to
somewhat
focus.
Clear-headed. Fortunately, I have autofocus, you know? It makes it a lot easier. But
so would it be fair to say, Joseph, that these photographs of your time there, probably no one else has ever captured before?
Yeah, I've been, it's been amazing. The response has been absolutely amazing. You always worry a little bit when you put your art out there, whether it be writing or photography. And we did, and at the very end of December, we did a 2-day presentation of the book and an exhibit. And we did it in the Civic Plaza. It was a Saturday and a Sunday. And on Saturday, we did it in late afternoon, and we ended up handing out about 200 books and signing about 200 books. And we timed it on Sunday. The idea was we'll do it after the Mass, because lots of people go to church. We'll do it after the Mass, and we're shocked. We're doing this presentation, and about 30 people showed up. And we thought, oh, they'll all show up after the Mass. And very few people showed up.
Just
and I thought, okay, well, you know, I get to go home early. And then word got out that we were handing out the book. And we signed books from 11 o'clock until 6 p.m., over 1,000. And I finally, at about 5:30, just turned to Javier, who's the co-author, and just said, you know, I can't do anymore, Javier. You know, I haven't eaten all day. I'm tired. You know, this has gone on for 6 hours. We got to call it a day, man. I just can't do anymore.
So that must have been very gratifying, as well as exhausting.
Yeah, and then since we're basically out of books now, I think I have 20 in my apartment in Mexico. And people, you know, I'll be standing. This happened last week. I was get a little breakfast. It's a tamale with a little bit of cheese in it and a sandwich and a
some chilies. A
cup. What's that?
But chilies
yeah.
In there.
Yeah, rajas, and it's really good. And a cup of piñol, which is a corn-based drink. And I was saying, oh, this is, you know, $3. I got my breakfast.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Somebody walked by, and she's like, hi, Joseph. I'm like, hey, how are you? Well, like, I have no idea who you are.
Do you think that this, if it hasn't already, you know, blossomed into, like, with other popular books, that you're going to go on The View or Good Morning America or Telemundo, you know, locally in Mexico City?
Well, it's definitely had a tremendous impact on the pueblo. People are Javier did the vast majority of the writing in the book, and people are learning about their pueblo. We were putting it together. Carla Manzanares is the woman who designed the book and is a friend of mine, and you know we were putting it together, and I actually said, you know, there's all this text. I don't know, but you know, people don't read anymore. Nobody's gonna read it, but you know.
But you can just make it an ebook, put it on Kindle.
But it, people are reading it. They're learning about their pueblo. The surprising thing is that most people in San Gregorio don't know about the ruins in the hills. And
right.
So they've learned about that. They've learned about the indigenous ceremonies. They've learned, even though Holy Week is a Catholic ceremony or Christian ceremony, and Easter, there are all these indigenous influences there. They've learned more about the Chinampas, so it's been great. I mean, I've just been blown away by the reaction.
Any interest from the, I'll say, either the scientific or the university level or within the government, the archaeological society?
Yeah, we finally got two archaeologists up in the hills. Javier, they came to the presentation and Javier has maintained contact with them, and he's taken them up. I believe there's an archaeologist named Juan Simbron who has published a book about ruins in other pueblos. I believe he's publishing an article about the these two monoliths that are up there. Most people know there are these two huge boulders that are carved in the hills. One is of a fertility goddess, and the other is of a priest. Of Xipe Totec is an Aztec god. And I believe Simbron is writing an article, published an article about them. And they're getting more interested in the ruins up there. But
might you start a lecture series at the University of New Mexico, not New Mexico, but maybe New Mexico too. But
I hope. There's the problem is there's so many sites in Mexico and so little money. Which is really a shame. And we're convinced that these ruins are an extremely important site. We've walked for 3 or 4 hours, and there's ruin after ruin.
Sure.
After ruin. We found a carving of a thing called a punctuated cross that is actually seen throughout Mesoamerica. It's known... there's a huge ruin just northeast of Mexico City called Teotihuacan that has these punctuated crosses and astronomical symbols. And Javier discovered one in the ruins in the hills outside of San Gregorio. Other
Does
carvings.
He have any theories besides Aztec or possible extraterrestrial markings, or he thinks it's all Aztec?
I haven't seen any of them, so that there's a lot of astronomical sites there. There's observatories.
I don't want to run out of time, and I'm very interested in not only your time, in San Gregorio, but some of the other refugee camps that you've spent time in.
Sure.
We know that we don't always get the complete story here on cable TV. Any firsthand things that you want to contradict what we've been told or emphasize?
Yeah.
And which ones have you spent time in?
Well, I've been down to Ixtepec, Hermanos en el Camino, which is a small city in Oaxaca. I've been to Chapachula to see the situation there in Chiapas. And I'm doing some projects now in Mexico City. What's happening now is there's a program in the United States called Migrant Protection Protocol, MPP. And in Mexico, it's called Quédate in Mexico, or Stay in Mexico. Central Americans who are seeking asylum in the United States, previously, they would cross the border and they would turn themselves in to Border Patrol and say, I'm seeking refugee status. I want asylum in the United States. And people are still held in detention centers in the United States. But then at a certain point, they would be released and they would wait for their court date in the United States. The Trump administration decided that wasn't a good idea. People aren't showing up. You have to go back to Mexico. Even if you have an appointment with an immigration court, you have to go wait in Mexico for your court date. People were staying and still are staying in northern cities, Reynosa, Juarez, Tijuana. And they're very dangerous. Cartels are kidnapping people, holding them for ransom. So people are leaving those northern cities because they're too dangerous, there aren't many services, and they're going to Mexico City, they're going to Monterrey, other large cities, and waiting for their court date. But if you consider Mexico City to be a safe place to wait, then other cities are horrendous.
From your time living there, there is no conversation in the press or side conversations that the Mexican government is going to in some way assist, make a small community where people can wait?
Nothing like that, but López Obrador has promised that people can work in Mexico. Previously, they were not able to work if they were waiting for their asylum application, whether in Mexico or in the United States. Now they can work, theoretically. The issue is there is very few jobs. Again, Mexicans are from southern Mexico especially are selling whatever they can on street corners in every major city in Mexico. If a Central American is doing that, that's what their job offer is. If there's a lot of discrimination in Mexico against Central Americans, they believe the myth that they're all gang members, so they're wary about hiring them. And as one lawyer in Mexico City told me, if you're waiting for your asylum application and you're looking for a job and you tell them, well, I don't know how long I'm going to be here. I've got to go to the United States for my immigration interview next week. And I don't know when I'll come back. The chances of getting hired are...
But you don't say that.
Well, yeah. Then you lose your job.
Right.
And then you have to try to figure out something else.
Not being that familiar with all the different nationalities that wander through that part of Mexico, is it very easy to say that that person is from El Salvador and that person is from wherever?
It is for Mexicans. It's okay. Not for me. They can tell from the accent immediately.
But not physically, visually.
Again, not for me.
Yeah.
I think that Mexicans might be able to. And it can certainly, there's a difference between people who look more indigenous than people who look more like Spaniards.
Right. Well, that's what I was thinking, Joseph, that there's so many different nationalities that have wandered into Mexico City over the millennia that I don't know if you can go that is what a Mexican looks like. Because it could be Spaniard, it could be indigenous, as you say, in some combination thereof.
Yeah, they definitely look at me and say, he's not Mexican. It's interesting for me when I see photographs of me with friends, I don't realize until I look at the photo how much bigger I am than people. I'm just looming over everyone. So I think, a woman that I interviewed last year, she had worked in a call center in somewhere in Central America. I can't remember what country, probably Honduras. And she was seeking asylum in Mexico because people realize, you know, the chances of getting asylum in the United States just non-existent. So they're looking for asylum in Mexico. She went to a job interview at another call center in Mexico City, and things were going well until they said, where are you from? And she said, Honduras. And they're like, nope, you're not. Well, you're all gang members.
Wow.
And you could lie, but eventually they're going to ask for identification.
Sure.
And it's going to say you're from Honduras.
Well, the asylum seekers who are coming on up, do they all have papers like we do in America, passport, driver's license?
Probably driver's license. I would doubt that most people have passports. And
but when you see in the old movies, I need to see your papers. Do they? No. What are papers?
They're, what Mexico has done, Mexico has become the wall that the Trump administration wants to build. They've sent their National Guard down to Chiapas and Rio Suchiate. The Rio Suchiate is the river that separates Guatemala from Mexico. And people just come over on, they call them rafts.
Right.
I don't know if you've seen photographs.
They're like logs.
They're these huge, I don't know, huge tire, inner tire tubes.
Okay.
And there's these thin slats of wood strapped on top. And people are standing on them and they're floating. And I was down there in the summer, which is the rainy season, so the river was deep and swift. And I went down with the UN High Commission on Refugees, and we're standing at the bank, and I'm looking at these boats, and one of the UN members turned to me and said, well, we can't cross, but if you want to, you can go ahead. And I just thought, you know, there are a lot of different ways to die. And mm-hmm. a lot of different times. Today is not a good day for me to die. Next time, I'll try it.
But sure.
It was like, I'll go when the river's low, maybe, and cross. But
what did they think you would learn by going over there alone?
Fear, I guess. Learn not to do it, not to push your luck.
Near death experience.
Just to go to the other side and talk with people who are waiting to come over.
Well, since there are, I guess, literally thousands and thousands of people from Honduras and Nicaragua and wherever, wanting to come into the United States, or probably more accurately, just wanting to get away from where they're at. When you have that many people, hasn't an organization formed within themselves to try and set up some kind of livable conditions while they're waiting?
It's a good question. I mean, there were the caravans, and there's just another caravan starting, so there's some sort of organization. the problem... again, it's a very complicated situation. I certainly don't have the answers. I have opinions. So a year ago, there were many caravans coming in. And initially, Mexicans were very welcoming. And it provided, moving en masse like that, it provided some sense of security. But then it was too much. Mexicans decided, and the government, even though they were promising to take care of people, overwhelmed. It's a poor country. People did what they could to support them, but then became too much and there was backlash. And since they're not allowed to cross into the United States, it's putting more and more strain there. And there are camps, I haven't gone yet to places like Reynosa, where there are migrant camps, people living in tents. The problem is, and this happens at the shelters too, and most of the shelters are run by all the ones that I've been at are run by Catholic priests and nuns.
Can you kind of describe a shelter? Because I hear about it, but I really don't know what it looks like.
It depends. There are certainly minimal services. People, they're doing what they can.
Is it a fenced-in area where people are not allowed to leave?
No, people can come and go as they want. The security there, the federal police, because it's dangerous. What happens when you do something like that, and with the best intentions to create a shelter that's safe for people, well, the cartels say, well, they've dense-packed these migrants, these asylum seekers. So they know, the cartels and the local gangs and the Maras, they know where to go. So they're, and especially in the northern cities in Mexico, they're just basically waiting out front for people to leave. And the lawyers in Mexico City are telling people aren't leaving the shelters. They're not leaving the encampments because it's too dangerous. They know they're going to get kidnapped. You had asked before about passports and other information. People carry almost nothing, no identification on them. I was in one shelter in La Patrona, a tiny shelter. And this, I believe his name was Jose, was teaching his nephew, I forget his name. It was an uncle and a nephew traveling together, memorizing the phone number that they needed for a relative in the United States, because you don't carry the phone numbers on you, because if and when you get kidnapped, which is a pretty good possibility, if they find that phone number, they're going to call your relatives and get ransom.
You know, I'm not an expert on kidnapping protocol, but it would seem to me I would go after some fat cat in Mexico City, not an asylum seeker who probably has nothing. What? How am I going to ransom them? They got nothing to offer.
It is very dangerous if you're wealthy in Mexico City, and I'm going to guess that most people have some sort of private security. In Mexico City, I passed these. It's a really expensive car shop, Maserati or something like that.
Something like that.
And I'm thinking, or a huge Hummer or SUV. And my thought is, if you're driving one of them, you're either a cartel member or you're a potential kidnap victim.
I would wear the rattiest clothes and an old beat up 1950s car.
Yeah, I think that's the safest thing
to do. Or move.
Yeah, but getting back to why are they doing so many impoverished people? Well, it numbers. I mean, if you kidnap a few hundred people and you get a couple of $1,000, because they can usually squeeze out a couple of $1,000, you're doing pretty well. And you don't have to worry about some private security guy with an AK-47 shooting back at you.
So what's... I'm just at a loss for words as to why the Mexican government doesn't intercede, because it's not good for their country to have all these gangs. There must be a way to maybe not eliminate it, but certainly make it less prolific.
Again, it's the level of corruption there.
So they get a percentage, possibly.
Not all the police, certainly. Probably in the northern cities or the states like Guerrero, Tamaulipas, they're controlled by cartels. I mean, Mexicans who used to vacation there don't go to those states anymore. Michoacan.
You're not going to get a job with the tourist board.
No. I remember somebody telling me one time, his parents lived in Michoacan, and he said, anytime you want to come visit, you know, you're welcome. And I'm thinking, again, there are a lot of different ways to die.
Right. So as a tourist or as a visiting person, are you allowed to have a firearm?
No.
So only the bad people have guns?
Yeah, probably.
Okay.
I would have to plead ignorance on this. My understanding is that private citizens, it's very difficult for a private citizen to get a gun.
But not difficult for a criminal.
No. I mean, we've supplied them. The United States is supplying the vast majority of illegal weapons in Mexico.
A kind of not part of this program, but makes me think about what we're doing about gun control. Where, you know,
not a whole heck of a
people
lot.
On the other side go, well, then only the criminals will have guns.
Right.
But different program and probably a different host to talk about that. Well, believe it or not, we're coming up in an hour. I'm going to just let you guide us to all the things that I've missed. Not all of them, but maybe some of them. I mean, like what for the people listening to this, it's kind of billed as, you know, an outsider insider's look at what's going on in the refugee camps and the San Gregorio community that you've been living in. Any big picture thoughts you want people to walk away with?
Yeah, I mean, I started doing projects in Mexico in 1997, and I did about a dozen before moving there, and I would spend a month. And most Americans, friends of mine, especially in the beginning, thought I was out of my mind. You know, it's a dangerous country, aren't you afraid? And there's always risk involved. But I found I've been very fortunate. I've been welcome to places. I've been to 9 states and dozens and dozens and dozens of pueblos. It's an incredibly generous country. People who are very poor are still willing to give you whatever they can, the best of what they can.
They also not realize how poor they are.
Yeah, I remember there's a group of women called Las Patronas who hand out food and water to Central Americans as they pass through the village on the train or walking. And I said, it's amazing. Even though you're poor, you do this kind of work. And Elena looked at me and said, we're not poor. I don't need for anything. I don't need a big house. I don't need a big fancy car. When you're happy with what you have, you're not poor.
That's a big thing to learn right there.
Yeah. It's definitely changed my worldview. I have temporary residency. I'll be there at least 3 more years. I'm probably going to look for permanent residency at the end of that time. It's just...
You're going to get a job? You're going to wait tables?
I'm sorry?
You're going to wait tables or work at the newspaper?
Don't need much money down there. I'm not allowed to work. I don't have that permit. And it seems too complicated to get. New Mexican bureaucracy look efficient.
Wow. I don't know if that's a compliment to them or an insult to us or a little bit of both.
I've dealt with both. Yeah. I just dealt
bureaucracy
with...
Is bureaucracy is a four-letter word.
It's very interesting. Yeah. I just think this idea that Mexico is some third world backwater country, view of too many Americans, the depth of the culture there. Mexicans had, I don't know which indigenous group, had invented zero. There are observatories down there that are made out of caves that can track solstices. I was part of a solstice celebration outside of San Gregorio. All this indigenous knowledge, to me, I mean, and you have to be realistic. I have to be realistic. 2019 was the most violent year in Mexican history since they kept records. So there are certain places I won't go and certain things I won't do. When I lived in Philadelphia, that's a dangerous city too. The 2 times I was robbed were within 2 blocks of the house that I lived in the afternoon, not at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Well, so, you don't want to go down to Central and Yucca in Albuquerque at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
So every place has that.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a matter of, but what I'm learning in Mexico is how to live more in the present. People there are less concerned with retirement and finding the right assisted living home. And one last thing I'll add, especially in San Gregorio, the pueblo in which I live, 3 important things are family, community, and faith. And everything, all the fiestas there are designed to reinforce those 3 things.
And even though it's a very Catholic part of the world, there must be Episcopalians and Lutherans and Mormons and Jews. Do they exist and everyone's cool?
Yeah, I have no religion. And I did a project on Holy Week. There's a group of young men, 14 young men called Los Barones, who basically run. They dedicate a year or two of their life to serving the church. And from Ash Wednesday to Easter Sunday, that 40 days, no contact with your girlfriend, no smoking, no alcohol. You can't go to parties. Extra time at the church, more masses, more prayer sessions. And one of them asked me one time, are you Catholic? And I said, no, I actually have no religion. And he said, that's okay. It doesn't matter to us.
It's interesting to me, regardless of how poor you are, you still seem to manage to have alcohol and tobacco.
Yeah, it's important. Takes the edge off of life, you know?
I guess. Maybe they should just give everybody alcohol and tobacco and not worry about clean water. So what's next for Joseph Sorrentino?
Well, I'm here for another, I'm here until Saturday, four days, and then I go back to San Gregorio Atlapulco. Interestingly, I'm doing a project on a pueblo called Chipilo, which is just outside of the major city in the city capital of Puebla. And Chipilo was founded in October of 1882 by a group of Northern Italians. I read about Chipilo, and I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. And that's what's fun for me now. It's like, oh, that sounds interesting, and I just go do it. So I went for a day, made a contact, went back, and I'm doing a couple of projects there. They've maintained their Italian identity. They speak a dialect from northern Italy, which has died out in northern Italy. They're from the Veneto region. Great Italian food. And
in the middle of Mexico.
Yeah.
And we need to get you a Travel Channel or food TV program.
Well, I'm publishing in this a magazine in the U.S. called El Restaurante, which is really different because I do the, I'm still doing the investigative journalism about Central American migration and life in the rural areas of Mexico, which are pretty, can be draining at times, really kind of difficult. And then I'm doing these articles about Chipilo and the great Italian food and some of the traditions that they still continue that are from definitely from Italy, not seen anywhere else in Mexico.
So you have a lot of legs. You could go in all kinds of directions over the next few years.
Yeah, if it doesn't earn a lot of money, I tend to do it. That's been my.
I didn't know if Bear Grylls could come down and do an adventure with you through the middle of Mexico. So when you leave Albuquerque, how do you get back to San Gregorio? You don't go to Mexico City Airport and then take an Uber.
Yeah, actually, I do.
Really?
Unless somebody picks me up. Yeah, it's only about 40 minutes, 45 minutes from the airport to San Gregorio because it is part of Mexico City. So it is, even though it's a pueblo and it is urban, but getting an Uber in San Gregorio is close to impossible. Once I got lucky. But it's not really possible. But
so when you're back in the United States and specifically Albuquerque for a few weeks, is there like a particular restaurant that you think about months in advance that I'm going to go here or I'm going to have?
Yeah.
where do you like to go?
Well, I've hit Richie B's, Mario's Pizza, and Giovanni's.
Yes.
Because until I found Chipilo in one Italian restaurant in Mexico City, Mexican pizza is very different. I like it, but sometimes I just need that real Italian-American pizza, so I hit those places.
Well, pizza's not Italian, but it's...
Yeah.
But I know what you mean.
And hit the Range. I dreamt about eating at the Range Cafe. Their spinach enchiladas, of course, green chile. They don't have anything like the green chili that's here in New Mexico.
Hmm.
Maybe in northern Mexico, maybe in Chihuahua.
Right.
But not southern.
And so do you have like guilty pleasures, like you leave the water running while you brush your teeth? Or
I drink, as soon as I hit Houston, I run to a water fountain. and I drink. And I don't, now I just rinse my vegetables and fruit. I don't have to sterilize them.
Sure. Oh, before I forget, Joseph, hopefully by the time 6 months or whatever, if someone is going to abqlive.tv and seeing or matthewbronson.com listening and or viewing the archive, what's the buzz on coronavirus in Mexico?
I haven't heard anything yet. If it hits Mexico, man,
it's going to hit everywhere.
Yeah, when it hits Mexico. It's going to be...
There's not the internal infrastructure to support that.
It's going to be really... Any impoverished country that it hits, when it hits, is going to be in deep trouble.
Do you think that their lifestyle of, eating less purified food or whatever has maybe built up a better immune system?
Well, I think their exposure again, going back to Chinampas and this raw sewage being dumped in there, I'm shocked. Chinamperos, the people who own the land and grow the crops there, they're putting their hands in this water without gloves.
Right.
They're handling everything without gloves. Why there's no cholera, I don't know.
Or dysentery?
I hope not.
Yeah, wow.
And there used to be dengue fever in that area, but there's not any, I don't know why. There's tons of mosquitoes. I think their immune system is being challenged much more than ours, so they're probably going to have more resistance. That virus is evolving very quickly. So the virus is going to adapt. And what's, you know, it's like any of these epidemics, the viruses will kill off a percentage of the population. And then there's a interplay between the host and the virus. The viruses that are killing their host aren't going to survive very long. So they become, over time, these viruses become less and less virulent because they're adapting to the host and the host is adapting to them.
So you have a lot of Typhoid Marys running around. Yeah, people but with in carriers, between, you just don't know.
Yeah, in between, right now, yeah. Obviously, it's going to do a lot of damage.
Well, let's talk about the book one last time. San Gregorio Atlapulco?
Atlapulco.
Cosmovisions, the vision of the cosmos. It's a photo essay as well as a book.
Yep.
So is it available anywhere other than the 24 you have in your trunk? Or?
Unfortunately, no.
But there may be a new publication.
We're hoping, we're looking for money to do another printing because we handed out 2,000 books and people are still asking for it. Javier and I are working on a book just about the ruins.
Right.
And we're talking, every time we get together, we talk about another book. So I think we're going to be doing some more work because there's so many interesting things about that pueblo.
Do you have a website, Joseph, for some of your photography?
SorrentinoPhotography.com.
That's pretty straightforward. SorrentinoPhotography.com. Well, thank you for coming up here to the hills of Placitas.
Well, it was good timing. I just happened to be in the neighborhood.
Excellent. So for KUPR 99.9 in the high desert of Placitas, New Mexico, this has been the Matthew Bronson Show. Thank you, Joseph.
Thank you.